Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 139. It's Monday, November 22nd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is on the rise again, so let's get started with a few COVID-19 stories. First up from the Hill, all American adults now eligible for coronavirus booster shots. Booster shots of COVID-19 vaccines are now available to anyone in the U.S. over the age of 18 after Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky signed off on the recommendations of an agency advisory panel. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices said that all adults are eligible, and in a second, last-minute vote, they explicitly recommended that everyone over the age 50 should get a booster. Previously, boosters had been authorized for anyone 65 and older, anyone at high risk because of work or where they live, or those with underlying medical condition. The conditions were broad, and providers were not supposed to ask for any sort of proof, but many people were confused. Less than 40% of people over the age of 65 have received a booster dose, according to CDC data. Broadly, only about 18% of all adults have received a booster. The guidance has now been simplified, making it clear that every adult is now able to get a booster 6 months after finishing the first two doses. The primary COVID-19 vaccination continues to provide good protection against severe disease and death, even as real-world studies show effectiveness against milder infection has waned. But cases have been steadily rising across the country, and authorities have said they want to stave off another winter surge. Studies have shown booster doses can increase antibody levels, which could reduce the ability of people to spread by making it harder for them to get infected in the first place. So again, folks, remember there's two buckets that we're really talking about when we're talking about vaccinations. One, the first and most important one, is to prevent serious disease, particularly hospitalizations and deaths. The second one is to prevent infection. And of course, preventing infection doesn't just prevent infection in the person who gets it. It prevents the possibility of being a chain of infection to somebody else, potentially somebody who may be even more high risk, either due to their biological factors or the fact that they may be unvaccinated. Okay, well, we've seen a little hit on the vaccination front, this from the Hill. OSHA suspends enforcement of COVID-19 vaccine mandate for businesses. The Occupational Safe and Health Administration, or OSHA, is suspending enforcement of the Biden administration's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for large private businesses after a federal appeals court upheld a stay on it last week. OSHA said in a statement published on its website last Friday night that while it is confident in its power to protect workers amid the pandemic, it is suspending activities related to the pandemic, citing the pending litigation. The court ordered that OSHA, quote, take no steps to implement or enforce the emergency temporary standard until further court order. While OSHA remains confident in its authority to protect workers in emergencies, OSHA suspended activities related to the implementation and enforcement of the emergency temporary standard pending future developments in the litigation, OSHA said. President Biden announced in September that the administration was rolling out a new rule that would require all private employees with 100 or more employees to mandate vaccines or weekly testing for all personnel, a guideline that has had the potential to impact nearly 80 million workers. The court said OSHA should, quote, take no steps to implement or enforce the mandate until further court order. And of course, the mandate was only going to take effect January 4th. And this also shows that OSHA is not only just waiting for the state, they're not doing anything to implement it. And of course, things take time to implement. So if that's been stopped, the bottom line is that this already would have been well into flu slash COVID-19 season. So by the time this gets rolled out, assuming it ever gets rolled out, it'll be even later and maybe moot for this winter's cold and flu season. Okay, well, COVID-19 politics is sometimes a blunt instrument. This up from Stat News. GOP opposition to vaccine mandates extends far beyond COVID-19. Right-wing politicians' resistance to vaccine mandates is extending far beyond COVID-19 immunizations, a startling new development that carries vast implications for the future of public health. In Idaho, a lawmaker introduced a bill that would define vaccine mandates of any kind as a form of assault. In Florida, a prominent state senator has called for review of all vaccine requirements, including those for immunizations that have enjoyed wide public acceptance for decades, like polio and measles, mumps, and rubella. And in Montana, the Republican governor recently signed into law a new bill that forbids businesses, including hospitals, from enforcing any vaccination requirements as a condition of employment. The bills represent the latest wave of resistance to the Biden administration's push to impose COVID-19 vaccine mandates for nearly all Americans. But the new across-the-board revolt against vaccine requirements of any kind, experts told Stat, could begin to reverse a century of progress against diseases that, thanks to vaccines, are afterthoughts to most Americans. In many cases, right-wing legislators' resistance to vaccine mandates has been cloaked in rhetoric specific to COVID-19 immunizations. Upon closer reading, however, many of the proposals they have floated, some of which have already been signed into law, apply to all vaccines, not just the three currently authorized in the U.S. to prevent COVID. Public health departments have a tough enough time vaccinating the public, even with the benefit of existing laws that support mandates, said Lily Kahn, the Senior Director of Infectious Disease and Informatics at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. When lawmakers step in to nullify those mandates, she added, the task becomes even more difficult. When there is a direct lack of trust based on misinformation, disinformation, and active efforts to undermine vaccination rates, that's really concerning, she said. We don't want people to think that not getting vaccinated can be the norm. Now, public health experts are beginning to express open alarm about plummeting childhood vaccination rates. In part, they stem from the pandemic itself. Many parents who have worked from home and whose children have attended school remotely have simply made fewer trips into doctor's offices for fear of COVID-19 exposure. Even before the pandemic, there were worrying signs that we were beginning to lose ground in a fight to immunize children against preventable childhood illnesses, including with the widespread measles outbreaks 2 years ago. Henrietta Four, UNICEF's executive director, said in a recent statement, "The pandemic has made a bad situation worse." Increasingly, though, those low vaccination rates may also be driven by turbocharged vaccine skepticism and outright misinformation that has clouded parents' judgment. Even before COVID-19, some U.S. communities have begun to experience outbreaks of disease that most of the country has largely eradicated. In two recent high-profile instances, a Somali-American community in Minnesota and a largely Orthodox Jewish town outside of New York City experienced major measles clusters in 2017 and 2019, respectively. In both cases, the outbreaks were driven by lower-than-ideal vaccination rates, which in turn stemmed from active misinformation campaigns. The new wave of resistance to vaccine mandates by any type, however, marks the start of a completely new era of vaccine politics. But an anti-vaccine generation might already be the reality. According to one recent poll, the partisan divide over COVID-19 vaccination has crept into the country's annual flu vaccination campaign. In 2020, one AP poll showed just a 4% gap between Democrats and Republicans' desire to be immunized against the flu. Two surveys conducted in 2021, however, paint a grimmer picture. Now, Democrats are more enthusiastic than Republicans about flu vaccines by about a 25% margin, according to Axios and Kaiser Family Foundation polls. Well, while COVID-19 may not have become endemic yet, apparently, vaccine misinformation is. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, one of the areas of COVID-19 disinformation has been around pregnancy and reproduction. Here's something related to that from The Hill. Pregnant people infected with coronavirus more at risk for stillbirths, says CDC study. Pregnant people infected with COVID-19 are at more risk for stillbirths, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analysis found, providing further evidence supporting COVID-19 vaccines for those carrying a child. The CDC defines stillbirths as fetal deaths that occurred at least 20 weeks gestation. As of September, about 97% of pregnant people hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 this year were unvaccinated. The risk for stillbirth increased when the Delta variant was predominant in the U.S. starting in July. Between July and September, 2.7% of deliveries among infected pregnant people resulted in stillbirth, while 0.63% of deliveries among non-infected people had the same outcome. Before the Delta variant was dominant, 0.98% of deliveries among those with COVID-19 resulted in stillbirth, compared to 0.64% of deliveries with non-infected people. So looking at the two different time periods, that before the time Delta variant was predominant and the time earlier, we see that with the previous strain that was dominant, stillbirths were about 50% more likely among non-immunized pregnant women. But when we got to the predominance of the Delta variant, that moved to almost fourfold. Okay, well, our neighbor to the north, Michigan, is on fire with COVID. This from The Hill. COVID-19 hospitalizations up almost 50% in Michigan in past 2 weeks. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Michigan have increased by almost 50% over the past 2 weeks as the Wolverine State faces a surge in infections. Michigan now has the second highest per capita rate of hospitalizations, just trailing North Dakota. COVID-19 infections in Michigan are up 78% over the past 2 weeks. Michigan's 7-day average of new reported cases is now higher than it was during the winter 2020 and spring 2021 surge in infections.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, if there's one thing for sure we can say about the COVID-19 pandemic is it has imprinted upon people the fact that pandemics are real. This from The Hill. 70% worried about another pandemic in their lifetimes. A new poll indicates that the prospect of a future pandemic is of significant concern for American adults. A new Morning Consult poll found that 70% of U.S. adults were concerned about another pandemic happening in their lifetime. Of those respondents, 31% were, quote, very concerned, and 39% were somewhat concerned about the issue, according to the survey. Democrats who responded to the poll were more concerned about another pandemic than Republicans, with 82% and 58% of those groups voicing concern, respectively. Vaccinated individuals who were polled also showed more concern than their unvaccinated counterparts, with 74% and 61% from each category saying that they were concerned, respectively. Morning Consult noted that $10 billion of the $1.75 trillion social spending plan will be allocated to prepare for future pandemics. Even so, just 47% of people polled said they thought the country would be ready to handle another health crisis like COVID-19. Okay, so where are people with Thanksgiving and the holiday seasons coming up? Let's do a couple stories on that. This from The Hill. 2/3 in new polls say their Thanksgiving gatherings will resemble pre-pandemic ones. 2/3 of Americans say their Thanksgiving gatherings will resemble pre-pandemic ones, a new Monmouth University poll found. The poll found 63% of Americans will celebrate Thanksgiving with the same number of people as they did before the coronavirus pandemic, with 5% saying there will be more people attending their Thanksgiving this year compared to pre-pandemic times. In 2020, only 46% of Americans said they would have a Thanksgiving with the same number or more people than in previous years. The poll shows 64% of individuals hosting Thanksgiving in their home will not ask guests if they have been vaccinated from the virus. Only 27% of hosts will require guests to be fully vaccinated. Only 26% of Americans are planning to spend Thanksgiving alone or only with immediate family members due to the virus, down from 45% in 2020, according to the poll. And more polling, also from The Hill, 72% plan to celebrate holidays with just their household. 72% of people who took part in a national survey from the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center said they plan to celebrate the holidays with only members of their household, compared to 79% last year. Now, if you're listening closely, you'll know that this is a very different number than the last number in the previous story, where it said only 26% of Americans are planning on spending Thanksgiving alone or only with immediate family members due to the virus, which was down from 45% in the previous year, 2020. So this 72% of people that are planning to celebrate the holidays with only members of their household, compared to 79% in the previous year, is a total number. But people, of course, the thing we're trying to get here is how much of that's due to the coronavirus pandemic. The poll also showed that just over half of the people surveyed would ask their guests to wear masks at holiday parties this year, compared to 67% in 2020. Half of people surveyed said they would ask their guests about their vaccination status, and 46% said they intended to ask unvaccinated guests to test negative for COVID-19 before attending the gathering, according to the poll. Okay, well, let's get to the Lucas County local COVID-19 update. It's not looking particularly well. The Lucas County average daily number of cases over the last week has gone up to 177 from 156 the previous week. The testing positivity rates, that's the percent of people that test positive, those that get tested, went up as well to 12.4% in Lucas County, up from 12% the previous week. And that took a jump in the state as well, up to 12.7%, up from 11.4% the previous week. The volumes of testing going up both locally and statewide. And there's a little bit of switcheroo here. This is the first time in months that the testing positivity rate in Ohio as a state has actually been higher than in Lucas County. That's not because Lucas County perhaps is doing all that great. It's just that the state is doing worse. And this is probably reflects the fact that rural areas are really getting into it right now as the cold and flu season hits. And the U.S. positivity rate, which almost got under 5% there for a while, bumped up a little bit to 6.4% from 6.1% the previous week. Well, nursing home active cases in Lucas County were at 41 in the last week, up from 34 the week before. That's 20 residents and 21 staff with active COVID-19 cases. And we had one more death in the long-term care facilities in Lucas County in the most recent week of reporting. Okay, well, it looks like the schools are seeing increased cases. The county a bit, but the state is seeing a big increase. And again, this probably reflects a lot of the rural counties. So in Lucas County schools, we had 42 staff and 142 students identified. We had 29 staff and 184 students identified in the most recent week. That's from 42 staff and 142 students. So it was a slight decrease in staff and a slight increase among students. But in Ohio, we had a big bump of about 25 or 30%, where we had statewide 720 staff up to 962 staff in the most recent week, then moving from 3,883 students to 5,073 students in the most recent week. The University of Toledo seems to be holding relatively steady. They had 38 identified cases, and their surveillance testing, the random testing that they do, they had a 1.1% positivity rate of that. And this is the first full week of that reporting where the UT vaccine mandate was in place, where people had to show proof by November 15th or subject themselves to weekly testing. Okay, well, big indicator, more important than even cases, is hospitalizations have spiked in Lucas County, up almost 25% over the last week. And hospitalizations are steadily increasing in Ohio. I've been doing that for the last couple weeks. Okay. Deaths, which is a lagging indicator, nationally have perhaps bottomed out, but there's still over 1,000 deaths each day, and it looks that's about as low as it's going to get. Lucas County had 39 deaths reported over the last couple weeks, so we're still seeing a few people on average each day dying from COVID-19 in Lucas County. Moving to vaccinations, those that are fully vaccinated, we're at 59.1% nationally. That bumped up 0.3% over the most recent week. That's higher than where we are in the state in Lucas County. The state is at 52.5% fully vaccinated, and the county at 51%. This newly fully vaccinated people, that rate has been slowing down on all fronts, state, local, and national, in recent weeks and months. Well, folks, you're listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's close out our COVID-19 coverage with a few stories about kind of the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic here. This first one from Conscien Health: child obesity spikes in England during the pandemic. This was not entirely unexpected, but the jolt is remarkable. New stats are out for the rates of child obesity in England for 2021, and the numbers are up even more than we might have expected. For children aged 4 or 5 years, prevalence jumped from 9.9 to 14.4% between the 2019-2020 school year and the spring of 2021. For children aged 10 to 11, the rates are up from 21 to 25.5%. This spike in England is entirely consistent with what we've seen in the U.S. for child obesity during the pandemic. The disparities in these data are perhaps the most jolting aspect they present. Obesity prevalence was more than twice as high for children living in the most economically deprived areas. Now, this kind of is interesting when you've got kind of an epidemic of obesity, you know, as a reflection of the pandemic. Because in both England and the U.S., we've seen child obesity rates rise steadily over recent years and decades. But this is the first time that you just see this spike. happening? I mean, in England, they were looking at people newly entering school, which would be their kindergartner, and people going into the fifth grade, I believe. So every year, they measure obesity in those two grades as a way of tracking it, and that's where we got this data from. But to see that kids entering school, it basically, the rate increased 50% from just under 10% to over 14%. Is quite astounding in a one-year period. Okay, next up from The Atlantic, another story about the aftermath here of the COVID-19 pandemic. Why healthcare workers are quitting in droves. And I'm just doing a short segment, actually, if this is a good longer read, if you want to go online, and I'll give that link later on in the show. About 1 in 5 healthcare workers has left their job since the pandemic started. Many have told me that they're bone-weary, depressed, irritable, and unusually for them, unable to hide any of that. Nurses excel at feeling their feelings in a supply closet or bathroom, and then putting their game face back on and jumping into the ring. But many are now constantly on the verge of tears, or prone to snapping at colleagues and patients. Some call this burnout, but Gerard Brogan, the director of nursing practice at National Nurses United, dislikes the term because it implies a lack of character, he told me. He prefers moral distress, the anguish of being unable to take the course of action that you know is right. Healthcare workers aren't quitting because they can't handle their jobs. They're quitting because they can't handle being unable to do their jobs. Even before COVID-19, many of them struggled to bridge the gap between the noble ideals of their profession and the reality of the healthcare business. The pandemic simply pushed them past the limits of that compromise. The healthcare workers who have stayed in their jobs now face a crushing downward spiral. Each resignation saddles the remaining staff with more work, increasing the odds that they too might quit. They don't resent their former colleagues, but some feel that medicine's social contract, wherein healthcare workers show up for one another through tragedy, is fraying. Before the pandemic, I knew exactly who I would be working with in every single role. There was a lot of unspoken communication, and my shifts were so smooth. But with so many people having left, the momentum that comes from trust and familiarity is gone. Expertise is also hemorrhaging. Many older nurses and doctors have retired early. People who know the one thing that happened 10 years ago that saved someone's life in a clutch situation. And because of their missing experience, things are being missed. The care feels frantic and sloppy, even though we're not overrun with COVID right now. Future patients may also suffer because the next generation of healthcare workers won't inherit the knowledge and wisdom of their predecessors. I foresee at least 3 or 4 years post-COVID where healthcare outcomes are dismal. That problem might be especially stark for rural hospitals, which are struggling more with staff shortages and unvaccinated populations.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, we know that when hospital capacity is stretched, bad things happen. This from The Hill. Hospital strain linked to thousands of excess deaths 2 weeks later, says research. A new analysis estimates that hospital strain during the pandemic is linked to thousands of ensuing excess deaths, signaling the significance of ensuring hospitals do not reach full capacity amid COVID-19 surges. The research published by the CDC predicted that when the nationwide intensive care unit capacity hit 75% capacity, an additional 12,000 excess deaths could be expected within the next 2 weeks. When hospitals surpass 100% ICU capacity, the study suggests 80,000 excess deaths would be expected 2 weeks later. Managing hospital capacity continues to be a challenge in different areas of the country. As of October 25th, the U.S.'s ICU bed capacity has reached beyond 75% for at least 12 weeks running. The research indicates the importance of controlling case growth and subsequent hospitalizations before severe strain, the report said, noting the effects of the limited capacity in hospitals fell more heavily on working age adults from marginalized communities. So to get an idea what that means, if the ICU hits 75% capacity nationwide and you get an additional 12,000 excess deaths in 2 weeks, that's almost 1,000 a day. That's almost equivalent to what we're seeing just from COVID-19 deaths. So those are excess deaths that are caused basically by a healthcare system that is collapsing or strained beyond the ability to give good care. This is why from the very beginning they talked about flattening the curve. Of course, the bottom of the curve is often higher than what healthcare capacity can deal with well. Okay, well, in another area that's been worsened by the pandemic, this from Stat News, U.S. overdose deaths topped 100,000 in one 12-month period, officials say. An estimated 100,000 Americans died of drug overdoses in 1 year, a never-before-seen milestone that health officials say is tied to the COVID-19 pandemic and a more dangerous drug supply. Overdose deaths have been rising for more than two decades, accelerated in the past 2 years, and, according to new data posted last Wednesday, jumped nearly 30% in the most recent year. Experts believe the top drivers are the growing prevalence of deadly fentanyl in the illicit drug supply and the COVID-19 pandemic, which left many drug users socially isolated and unable to get treatment or other support. The number is devastating, said Catherine Keyes, a Columbia University expert on drug abuse issues. It's a magnitude of overdose deaths that we haven't seen in this country. Drug overdoses now surpass deaths from car crashes, guns, and even flu and pneumonia. The total is close to that for diabetes, the nation's number seven cause of death. The new data shows many of the deaths involve illicit fentanyl, a highly lethal opioid that 5 years ago surpassed heroin as the type of drug involved in the most overdose deaths. Dealers have mixed fentanyl with other drugs, one reason that deaths from methamphetamines and cocaine are also rising. Okay, well, let's switch gears back a bit and look at some of the efforts to combat some of the problems that I've been dealing with here. This from Stat News. People in states without Medicaid expansion can't wait any longer to build back better. Lawmakers are in the midst of deliberation over the Build Back Better Act, a landmark legislative package to transform the U.S. for the better. One piece of the bill that would have a huge impact is a provision that would provide health care to millions of uninsured Americans who live in states that haven't expanded Medicaid by opening up coverage for people with incomes below a certain level. Here's how Build Back Better would have such a huge impact on healthcare. The Affordable Care Act enables states to expand Medicaid to people with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty line. That's $37,000 for a family of four, with the federal government covering the vast majority of the costs. Most states have already taken advantage of this program, unlocking health care for millions of people. But 12 states, primarily in the South, still refuse to expand Medicaid. That leaves a huge coverage gap for people who aren't poor enough to currently access Medicaid, but also don't make enough to get subsidies for coverage to the marketplace, which was created by the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, so people could shop for coverage. All told, that amounts to 2.2 million people, most of whom are people of color. More than 500,000 of these people are essential workers, like nurses, bus drivers, and cashiers, and are disproportionately susceptible to the wrath of COVID-19. The Build Back Better Act would close this gap by temporarily allowing people with incomes below 138% of the federal poverty level to access marketplace coverage while paying virtually $0 in premiums. That's life-changing. People could get regular preventive care and detect health issues like cancer or heart disease or diabetes before they become dangerous. They could get consistent care to manage chronic conditions. They could get treatment for mental health issues. The list goes on. Indeed, a mountain of research shows how Medicaid expansion saves lives. It prevents premature deaths, improves the management of chronic conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure, ensures the early detection of cancer, reduces instances of depression, and more. Low-income Americans deserve the chance to thrive and contribute meaningfully for their communities. Without health care, that's all but impossible. So this is a good part of the Build Back Better Act. The one commentary I'd give to this, though, is that, you know, as people are advocating for like Medicare for all, probably should be Medicaid for all is even better. But the reality is what this fix that they're trying to do in these 12 states that have refused to expand Medicaid is they're actually opening up the federal marketplace, which is private health insurers. So basically what you're doing is you're just giving a complete total subsidy for these private health insurance plans. So it's good because individuals get care, although it's not entirely clear to me if that'll eliminate all the co-pays and out-of-pocket expenses that you might have in a Medicaid plan, but it would go a long ways. But the long-term point being is that this incremental approach where basically we're subsidizing this inefficient, profit-driven, private health insurance, healthcare-driven plan is not necessarily the best way and may not be as good of a stepping stone as we'd like to actually get some kind of universal health coverage and more of a single-payer kind of Medicare for all or Medicaid for all type plan. Because the perverse incentives that are in our system are driven by the for-profit nature, which is driven by the minority of people that are actually covered by private health insurance. Okay, well, this next story from The Hill covers another thing included in the Build Back Better plan. Congressional Budget Office, Democrats' package saves about $160 billion on drug prices. Provisions to lower prescription drug prices in President Biden's Build Back Better package would save the government about $160 billion over a decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO. That includes about $80 billion in savings from allowing Medicare to negotiate lower drug prices in limited instances, and another roughly $80 billion in limiting drug price increases to the rate of inflation. The measure also caps out-of-pocket costs for drugs at $2,000 per year for seniors on Medicare and $35 per month for people taking insulin. Other healthcare provisions in the package would extend enhanced financial assistance under Obamacare that helps people afford their premiums and subsidize coverage for about 2 million people falling through the cracks in the 12 GOP-led states that refuse to expand Medicaid. CBO estimates that in total, 3.4 million fewer people would be uninsured under the bill. CBO says the measure would also save about $140 billion from repealing a Trump administration rule seeking to reform how drug companies give discounts to companies known as pharmacy benefit managers. And another win, this from Stat News, a win for Black maternal health advocates as Congress moves to set up a new VA program. Proponents of addressing America's Black maternal mortality crisis scored a win this week in Congress, overwhelmingly passing legislation to set up a $15 million maternal care program within the Department of Veterans Affairs. It is the first bill in the Black maternal health momnibus to make it through Congress and now awaits President Biden's signature. The momnibus is a collection of a dozen bills aimed at eliminating the health care inequities that Black women and birthing people face. Black women in the U.S. are three times more likely to die during childbirth than white women, according to the CDC. Also included in the momnibus is the Kira Johnson Act, which seeks to establish funding for community-based groups to provide Black pregnant people with more support. The bill Congress passed last Tuesday, called the Protecting Moms Who Served Act, was passed on a 414-9 vote. In addition to the new VA maternity care program, it will require the Government Accountability Office to report the deaths of pregnant and postpartum veterans and to focus on any racial or ethnic disparities. Okay, well, this next story is a good comparative study of two health systems, the United Kingdom versus the U.S., this from Stat News. The U.K. is on its way to eliminating cervical cancer. Here's why the U.S. isn't close. A decade ago, a London cancer prevention researcher predicted that the United Kingdom's national HPV vaccination campaign would take more than 15 years to prevent a majority of cervical cancers. So when he analyzed the data this year, he was stunned to find that the vaccine may already have nearly eliminated cervical cancer in the U.K. among young women. If this is right, Peter Sassini of King's College London said of his findings, cervical cancers could be reduced to about 50, just 50 cancers in the whole of the UK for women under 30. It's really exciting to see that day come. Excitement and just joy. That joy was tempered with envy in the United States, where some of society's peers lamented that the HPV vaccination rate for teenage girls lags far behind, about 59% in the US versus more than 85% in the UK. The analysis published last week in The Lancet suggests the UK has notched a major public health victory against cancer through vaccinating the vast majority of young women against HPV, said Alison Kempe, a pediatrics professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine who did not work on the study. It's very strong and fairly direct data that the vaccine reduces cancer, she said. It's an incredible achievement to have, first of all, GOT rates that high among girls 12 to 13 years old. You can see the amazing results of that, almost eliminating a very common and invasive cancer, she said. And I'm very, very disturbed that we can't do better in this country. Certain strains of HPV, or human papillomavirus, can cause cellular abnormalities. Those anomalies can develop into six different kinds of cancer, all genital in nature except throat cancers, but it's most known for its association with cervical cancer. When the Food and Drug Administration first approved an HPV vaccine in 2006, health experts hailed the decision as a major breakthrough for women's health. It was the first vaccine that could prevent this common and invasive cancer that kills thousands of women in the U.S. each year. An epidemiologist looked ahead with the hope that one day, widespread vaccinations would trample HPV-related cancers into the past. Some countries, it appears, are on their way to achieving that. The UK implemented its national vaccine program for HPV in 2008, offering two doses of the shot in schools to every adolescent girl. At over 85%, the acceptance rate for the immunization is sky high there. To understand the effect of that on cervical cancer in his study, Sassiani and his colleagues compared women in the UK who were offered the vaccine in school as teens and preteens against slightly older women who were not offered the shot, all under the age of 30. The team found that women who were offered the vaccine at age 12 and 13 had an 87% lower risk of cervical cancer than those who were not offered the vaccine at the same age. The risk of an abnormal pap smear, a screening test that detects signs of potential cervical cancer, was lower by 97%. That means cervical cancer becomes a very rare cancer instead of what was one of the most common cancers in young women. Based on their findings, they extrapolated that the vaccination will drive cervical cancer cases down to 50 per year among women under 30 in the UK, from the more than 400 per year before HPV vaccination. In the US, the HPV vaccine has not had such success. Instead, it's had to slog through a quagmire of social and economic objections since the day it was approved. Some pointed out that the shot was just plain expensive, making it hard for states to justify school vaccine mandates. But the greatest opposition to the vaccine has come because it became entwined with the subject of teen sex. Some advocacy groups opposed mandating HPV vaccines since HPV can be transmitted sexually, arguing instead that public health efforts be focused on keeping kids from having sex. I think the biggest mistake was the way this vaccine was introduced into this country, Kempe said. There was a lot of discussion about sexual activity. The focus was on sexual activity and getting it into early adolescence before sexual activity. That was a big mistake. Parents got concerned that this meant their child was sexually active or it would trigger sexual activity. Kempe said that led the vaccine to be treated differently from other cancer-preventing vaccines, like the hepatitis B vaccine. From the start, Kempe said, doctors and scientists should have focused on the fact that the HPV vaccine is a cancer prevention vaccine, not one that stops a sexually transmitted infection. It doesn't even take sexual intercourse to transmit HPV, Kempe said. Heavy petting can do it. Parents might think my child is not having sexual intercourse, so therefore they don't need this vaccine. That's a fallacy. Today, the whiff of sexual activity still lingers around the vaccine, leading parents to continue to refuse the shots for their kids, or in some cases, halt research on the immunization. Eric Adebokeye, a cancer epidemiologist now at Southern Illinois University, once tried to initiate a study of the vaccine at a Roman Catholic university. The school said, "No, you can't do that," he recalled, so the study never happened. They didn't want to associate the school at all with the HPV vaccine, so religion plays a really big role in hesitancy. But things haven't been all bad. The vaccination rate for HPV has climbed steadily over the years, and about 75% of adolescents get at least one shot, which might provide ample protection for at least several years, he pointed out. The cervical cancer screening has also helped to catch and freeze cancers before they can start. Today, there are about 14,000 new cases of cervical cancer diagnosed in the U.S. each year. It used to be really high, like 40,000. Now it's become relatively small. That said, there are five other cancers that HPV causes: penile, vaginal, vulval, anal, and head and throat cancers. It's much harder to screen for those cancers, and there are still about 45,000 cases overall of HPV-associated cancers diagnosed each year. And most of these shots are probably And most of these cases are probably preventable simply by giving a very safe and effective shot. The University of Colorado's Kempe said that might be done better by employing a few hesitancy fighting strategies, like buy-in from trusted community leaders, and importantly, finding the right ways to communicate public health messages. Kempe said that might not only help push up rates of the HPV vaccine, but also the COVID-19 vaccine. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears and do a couple stories on mental health. This from Stat News. Why is the CDC missing in action on severe mental illnesses? In October, the CDC updated its list of medical conditions that contribute to worse outcomes with COVID-19 infection. It's an essential list used for prioritizing testing, treatment, and vaccination. For the first time, it includes, quote, certain mental health conditions. Specifically, according to the CDC, having mood disorders, including depression and schizophrenia spectrum disorders, can make you more likely to get severely ill from COVID-19. It's good to see the CDC updating its list, which for the last several months has included asthma, hypertension, liver disease, and substance use disorder, among others, all conditions which lower risk profiles for adverse COVID outcomes than serious mental illness. These are mental disorders that seriously impair functions such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression. Scientific reports from around the world have demonstrated higher rates of hospitalization and death from COVID-19 in people with serious mental illness for nearly a year. Why has it taken the CDC so long to recognize the science? When it comes to mental illness, the CDC has been mostly missing in action, not only during the COVID-19 pandemic, but for years before it. To know what the CDC prioritizes, just look at the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. It's open-source publication loaded with information about death and disability from a range of causes. Yet search for schizophrenia over the past 5 years reveals a conspicuous absence of reports beyond noting an association with marijuana and how it is distinct from ADHD. There's an abundance of information on autism, anxiety, and mild depression, but serious mental illness, which affects 14.2 million Americans, is oddly missing from MMWR. There is a pattern here. While the CDC reports on infectious disease deaths across the country weekly, suicide death rates have, until recently, lagged by 2 years. What we know about the prevalence of serious mental illness and how many people are seeking treatment for it comes largely from reports of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, a service agency that lacks the epidemiological firepower of the CDC and has failed to include institutionalized and homeless people in its population-based studies of the prevalence of serious mental illness. Deaths of despair, that is, deaths from suicide, overdose, and alcohol-related disease, likely surpassed 175,000 in 2020, more than deaths from any infectious disease except COVID-19, and any form of cancer except lung cancer. But this number is a rough estimate because there is no rigorous real-time surveillance system for tracking deaths of despair. The truism from business, you can only manage what you measure, is equally relevant for public health. To its credit, the CDC has implemented the Household Pulse Survey to track anxiety and depression during the pandemic. This is a great example of responding quickly to an urgent need, and it demonstrates how the agency can track behavioral health symptoms relevant to the pandemic. The problem is that it continues to neglect the most severe behavioral health problems. No one is tracking people with serious mental illness. The COVID-19 pandemic has revealed the importance of a public health infrastructure for preparedness and surveillance. The CDC's mission is clear. As the nation's health protection agency, CDC saves lives and protects people from health threats. To accomplish that, the CDC conducts critical science and provides health information to protect our nations against expensive and dangerous health threats and responds when these arise. There can be little doubt that mental illness is an expensive and dangerous health threat. Individuals and families struggling with serious mental illness need the CDC to respond to it. Okay, well, next up on mental health, here is a little bit of a better story on a win, but how hard it's going to be to scale up these kind of efforts. This from Stat News. A telehealth effort to treat PTSD and bipolar disorder in rural areas shows huge gains. Now comes the hard part. A multi-year effort to pipe big city mental health providers to rural communities over video accomplished a trifecta of telehealth victories. It reached people who wouldn't otherwise have access to mental health care, it tackled difficult diagnoses that don't have simple answers, and it stretched how many people the most skilled providers can treat. Now comes the inevitable question that follows any technology breakthrough. Does it scale? Over a four-year span, a study led by researchers at the University of Washington sought to deliver treatment to rural patients with post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar disorder, complex diagnoses for which treatment is often located hours away, if it's accessible at all. Researchers connected psychiatrists and psychologists to primary care clinics within federally qualified health centers in three states that didn't have any on staff. Just over 1,000 people participated in the project, the study to promote innovation in rural integrated telepsychiatry, or SPIRIT. And the results were overwhelmingly positive. In a recently published paper, the researchers reported that patients showed a 32% improvement on a scale of mental health functioning. The findings underscore the potential of technology to address gaps in rural healthcare. It goes to show that if you provide evidence-based treatment to patients in underserved settings that haven't had access to it before, that you can just make huge gains in those clinical settings. John Fortney, the lead researcher and a professor of psychiatry at the University of Washington, told STAT. And we should be thinking about working harder to provide services in those settings. Even at the beginning of the study in 2016, a Zoom subscription and a webcam were inexpensive and simple to set up, and providers who'd never delivered care over video adapted quickly. The novel design of the trial meant the healthcare system needed to be rewired, a complex undertaking with many moving pieces. The urban mental health providers needed to be credentialed and privileged to provide care in the health centers. They needed access to medical records, billing and insurance arrangements needed to be hammered out, and providers had to be trained in new workflows. And in some cases, they needed a crash course and a new spin on treatment modality called collaborative care, in which the local primary care staff deliver the behavioral health treatment with support from the urban experts. Patients were randomized to one of two types of treatment, a collaborative care plan or a referral system. In the referral group, patients were connected from clinics over video to a psychiatrist from a state medical school who started an ordinary course of treatment, perhaps in collaboration with a psychologist, which might be a 12-session course of cognitive processing therapy for PTSD or medication management and cognitive behavioral therapy for bipolar disorder. In the collaborative care group, a psychiatrist made a diagnosis over video, but then faded into the background as a care manager at the local clinic, usually a nurse or social worker, took over to deliver treatment. Any prescriptions were written by the patient's primary care physician at the clinic. The care manager regularly communicated with the patient in person or over the phone and periodically spoke with the psychiatrist to discuss any changes needed in treatment strategy. There are more than two decades of research showing collaborative care can be beneficial in treating anxiety and depression, but applying it to PTSD and bipolar disorder and connecting it to telehealth are newer ideas. Fortney said the concept was met with early skepticism among some physicians who didn't have experience writing prescriptions for mood stabilizers, but pretty much all of them by the end of the study felt comfortable treating those disorders, he said. While patients in both arms showed significant improvement, collaborative care had a clear advantage over the referral model as a method for getting more people treatment. That's deeply valuable in a world where the number of professionals with the highest training is in short supply. The collaborative care model has the capacity to treat 2 to 3 times more patients for it, he said. While every person in the referral model in rural areas means that one less person in the urban area that could be treated. While Fortney and his colleagues overcame the hurdles to get the staff, logistics, and funding needed to pull off the approach in a study, pushing the new collaborative care methods to the next level required just a little more hand-holding. It can take months and a hefty financial investment to integrate urban providers into a rural clinic. A policy paper based on the SPIRIT experience describes several steps federally qualified health centers must undertake to bring in external telemental health providers into the fold, including ensuring remote electronic health record access, contracting with state medical schools, securing the right credentials for the new providers with Medicaid and insurance companies, and purchasing additional malpractice insurance. On top of this, collaborative care introduces a complex new workflow, including an additional administrative layer called the registry that helps care managers and consulting psychiatrists track how patients are doing. As part of this tracking, collaborative care requires rigorous measurements of patients' conditions. While PTSD has an established rating scale to capture symptoms, bipolar disorder does not. So as part of the study, researchers developed and published a mania scale that could be used for patients with bipolar disorder in conjunction with the PHQ-9 for depression. The novel rating scale is valuable for keeping tabs on progress, but also adds another new element to learn. The researchers sought to make the process as painless as possible,
But the implementation was still tricky, said Rachel Sewell, a licensed marriage and family therapist. Sewell, a care manager at Moses Lake Community Health Care in the agriculture region over 150 miles east of Seattle, had had no experience with collaborative care when she was hired to work on the study. Despite receiving what she calls some of the best training in support of her career from the study, the learning curve was steep, she said. As the clinic got up to speed, she was working out of three different electronic health record systems at one point, and it took the clinic time to find a steady psychiatrist to work with her. Sewell also had to learn the ropes of providing behavioral activation therapy, an approach using collaborative care that encourages patients to do things that jumpstart a cycle of positive activity. Still, for the health center, which had just started to work in behavioral health, the study showed how powerful it could be and how well it could serve our patients, Sewell said. The business case for collaborative care is also murky. The health centers in the study volunteered to participate, and the psychiatrists and psychologists who were all affiliated with academic medical centers were motivated to participate. But at a broader scale, it might be hard to find such buy-in among specialists who need to work behind the scenes in a virtual collaborative care model. There's not a lot of incentive to overcome all the red tape to do the telehealth when all you've got to do is hang the shingle out and there's patients walking through your door all day long paying out of pocket, said Fortney. Ultimately, he said, better payment systems for more kinds of mental health treatment will be necessary for this type of approach to make a dent in access to care. I think it all comes down to reimbursement, which shouldn't be surprising in our society. There are billing codes for collaborative care, but they're not very generous, he said. Some of the groundwork has been laid. Medicare covers collaborative care nationally, and Medicaid now covers it in many states. Startups and large insurers have taken an interest in the model, though coverage for the complex diagnoses may lag behind. Following the success of Spirit, the Ames Center of the University of Washington is working on a follow-up application to the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which funded the Spirit study, for a grant to help as many practices as possible implement the models from the study. Verna Little, the Chief Operating Officer of Concert Health, which helps primary practices set up collaborative care and is signed on to be part of the follow-up, told STAT the ongoing work from the University of Washington has been instrumental in creating replicable infrastructure for organizations who want to use the modality for anxiety and depression. What's needed now, she said, is similar guidance for other diagnoses. The rural providers are the only game in town, she said, and so they actually oftentimes are way more receptive to trying to figure out how to manage people. So if they have a system, if you had something that they could plug and play, they would probably be way more likely to do it. Okay, well, I'd like to close reporting today with a little change of pace, environmental story from Popular Science. A little bit interesting, perhaps even a little funny. Our meat habit is causing pollution issues by way of our poops. Cleaning up human sewage is an international issue. As growing populations grapple with how to properly process and dispose of human waste, a significant amount of sewage ends up in waterways around the world. More than 2 billion people worldwide lack any sanitation, which means that millions of tons of human waste enter into the environment untreated every year. And in wealthier countries like the U.S., most treated sewage is placed directly into rivers and oceans. Human waste also introduces too much nitrogen in our waterways, which causes watersheds to experience dead zones that used to house marine life. The research team used data sets to detail whether populations were urban or rural, how much protein was consumed per person, how much nitrogen was then excreted, and how much of the waste was sanitized and how. The more meat a person eats, the more nitrogen is found in their waste, which means more nitrogen ends up in the waterways near them. This happens because nitrogen comes from amino acids which make up protein. The breaking down of these proteins during digestion creates the nitrogen that ends up in wastewater. Nearly half as much nitrogen comes from wastewater as agricultural runoff globally, which is a huge fraction. The whole ecosystem can tip into a highly degraded state when nutrient levels are too high, said co-author Ben Halpern, a marine science professor at UC Santa Barbara. So while agriculture takes the cake for the majority of runoff-induced issues, there's a lot that can be done for both an ecological and public health benefit when it comes to our own poo. Eating less animal products could help. From a nutritional perspective, I think our excess protein thing is actually a health issue too, and apparently it's a significant environmental problem because the nitrogen that you excrete is all because it's excess protein, more than what you need. Okay, well, I have 7 bonus articles that you can read online. I'll give the link after I list these. First up, Why I'm embarrassed to receive a COVID booster, a narrative from a global health worker living in the first world. 2, hospital waste, not masks, our plastic scourge of pandemic. There's been some play that leads into some kind of anti-masking sentiment that masks are this huge plastic scourge, but actually hospital waste from around the world is the real driver of plastic pollution. Article 3. California has a new battle plan against environmental injustice. The nation is watching. Can it be replicated? 4. Lessons from a Flint water crisis researcher about building trust in science during the pandemic. From science, both from a traditional point of view and from citizen scientists and activists. Article 5. What happens after a campus suicide is a form of prevention too. Preventing suicide contagion. 6. Indigenous healing poses a challenge and opportunity for global mental health. And lastly, an interesting story, why researchers are turning to music as a possible treatment for stroke, brain injuries, and even Parkinson's. Music has the ability to activate multiple centers of our brain at once, and it's these integrations rather than specific areas of the brain that seem to be helping our mental health and our brain health. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some drugs.